Good morning. The scriptures just read are a good explanation of singleness. But I am going to just quote one scripture that has been important for me. I've worked with scriptures all of my life, everywhere I've been. But Romans 11:29, for the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. This nurtured me many periods of my 87 years of life. I grew up in a family of Amish children. There were 10 in the family, and I was number 8. And I was number 5 of 7 daughters. My parents were very spiritual, and we always had family devotions in German. We also learned from English Bible story books. And because my parents did not approve of what was happening with the young people, they decided to move to Iowa, to Kelowna, Iowa, in 1940 from Kokomo, Indiana. We ended up moving to a second farm nearer Kelowna and less hilly and muddy roads. It was quite a shock to go from paved roads to hills and mud. It was hard to get used to it, even as an Amish person. Another thing that was a big change was the school, a one-room school with one teacher with only 40 other students besides our 4, and it was called Snake Hollow, which was a nice name. There was no library, but there was one book available, Betty Lou of Big Log Mountain, and you know, I could hardly imagine that. But one thing the teacher did, she usually got 30 books from the county library every month. I often read most of them. And along the line, the teacher said to me, I think you're going to be a teacher someday, Bertha. And that was interesting that someone said that. In the final county exam, I was one of the top 10 in the school offered. And this same school offered the GED tests, which I took. It made college possible, which was a dream of mine, because I could not go to high school. I worked for my parents and later in the community after I was 21. I managed to get a job at the University Hospital in Iowa City as a nurse's aide, and I worked there for 6 months. And then I enrolled at EMC, it was called Eastern Mennonite College in Harrisburg, Virginia, in a BS in L.Ed. program for teachers. My money finished after 1 year, and I tried and tried and tried all summer long to get back to the hospital, but to no avail. I couldn't manage to get in. And one thing I did that summer was go with the Howard Hammer program to Youngstown, Ohio, as a personal worker. And I was still Amish at this point. And that was an interesting experience for me because we would call at homes. But out of that experience, it came to me that I must change my church membership. And I decided to join a conservative Mennonite church. And also, I continued to try to get back to the hospital. But I didn't until the day after I could no longer go to the college, I got an invitation, and I worked for a full year. And thus it was that I finished college in 5.5 years with no debt. Can you imagine that? It's impossible today. At 19, I had attended the first Amish Mission Conference that was ever held in Kelowna. And I knew from that experience that I would be in mission work someday, but I knew not where or when. And one thing that happened for me along the line, in my senior year, I ended up rooming with a missionary home on furlough from Somalia. It was her first furlough. And I graduated in the spring and set sail with her and others for Africa in the fall. I was processed. I went to meet the people that interviewed and It was 12 bishops looking serious as death. And I, they luckily passed me anyhow. We boarded a second ship in Italy, but my parents came to New York to see me set sail, and it was partly because they were in the area anyhow. A friend had taken me and all my things to Salonga, and we had to take many things because we had to take materials that we could use for teaching after we got there. The board, the Eastern board, took six of us to the ship in New York. When we arrived, they didn't have a harbor at that time. And we arrived, and they put us on little boats and rowed us in. And all a new experience. And, of course, I was used to horse and buggies. I wasn't used to many things. But I was told, I lived in one of the homes that was provided, that I would have 6 months of Somali language study. Well, lo and behold, after 3 months, I was told I'm going to be moved down to Jemama, which was 265 miles south from where I lived at Mogadishu. And I went. There was no discussion with me about it or anything after 3 months. Well, guess what? When I got to Jemama, which was 265 miles south, the school hadn't even been built. And so one of the things I did, and this was two things that were important for me. My father was an extrovert and could relate to anyone. And I was more of an extrovert than an introvert like my mother was. But my mother was a bookworm, and that was a gift to me as well. So one of the things I did early there, I would go to the village of Jemama, or Margarita, the Italians called it, but Jemama was the Somali name. And I would stop in at every house that invited me for tea. And very, very often, I would have three places in a day. And I would go to the village as often as I could. And by doing that, I learned much about the Somali culture, much more than I had learned in Mogadishu. But I learned their way of hospitality, their way of caring for people, and so on. It was a gift to do that. When I finally got to the school, when it was built, I had 13 students, and one of them was a girl. One reason there were so few, they wanted English schools, but they had to pay to be in our school. And, you know, that was not always easy. I was grateful that I had one girl also because I always was interested in what happened to the women. In July 1, 1960, independence came, and my students at that point, I had around 40, had their uniforms on, the white and blue uniforms, which were the colors for Somalia, and they went to sing at the mayor's house for independence, which was a blessing. In my third year, when A.J. Metzler from Scottsdale came to visit Africa because he wanted to check the bookstores in Tanzania and in Ethiopia, and Paul Crable had traveled with him, and Paul was the head of Eastern Board at that time. And I said to Paul, did A.J. Metzler bring us a bookstore? He paused a little bit and looked at me and said, do you want a job? And just like that, it was decided that I would manage Provident Bookstore in Somalia. I went for some training when the school year finished. I went to the U.S., but I also went to Ethiopia and checked their bookstore on my way back. The store was the first thing that was not on the mission compound. Everything else was moved off. Everything else stayed on the mission compound, which is a certain kind of security. But I happened to be very much like my father and could relate to anyone. And I found that that Amish background was very, very helpful in Somalia because I was used to being different. It didn't bother me that people thought of me as being different. I felt at home that way. I started out at the mission, and then I moved downtown with the store. And I had promised the landlord that I would not do anything counter-Islamic in the store. Thus, I never sold the Bible in the store. I only sold English books or books written by English, in English by some people that had been trained at different places. Well, they had a council for all the men, and all the men were important and could be part of that council. But Sister Beachy could not be a part of it, though I was always in charge of a program, just like the men were, but mine wasn't as important. And I kept working and working and working at this because it helped me a lot. Well, a new person came out, and he was on council, and he promptly said in a public meeting, "I was just at the Catholic bookstore, and they sell the Bible. Why isn't Bertha selling the Bible at the New Africa booksellers?" Well, it was a good question, but I had promised I would not counter anything that was counter-Islamic. Well, the thing that saved me was one of the first people to go to Somalia, a wife spoke up. She said, "If Bertha has to do that, I want to go home first." And that helped that they didn't require me to do it, that I could do it otherwise. It was the first time that we had something that wasn't on the mission compound. I ordered my books from England in English and sold them to many schools, but I didn't sell the Bible, of course. It was sold from our mission office on the compound. I was more approachable than some of the men were in the mission, and I always tried to get the council meeting to allow me to be present. I was invited to come to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to write the Somali story. Well, the very people that always loved everything that I wrote from Somalia when I was there criticized everything that I wrote represent the mission in a story. Later on, I left that, but one of the things I did while I was at that place and had been rejected, I worked in Provident Bookstore in Lancaster. And because of that, I ended up moving to Goshen, Indiana to manage a Provident Bookstore because of that connection. And while in Lancaster, I had spoken about Somalia many times. At one place, I read 75 times. I'm not sure it was really that often. But I spoke about Islam and Somalis very often. And along the line, I had developed an ulcer. But I was part of a women's group that prayed for me, and the ulcer was healed. Before I had left for Somalia, I had really prayed every day that if I was not to go, God would keep me at home. And I was perfectly open to that. And if I had misunderstood, I would just not go if there would be a reason for not going. Well, it turned out my church that I attended had their yearly conference while I was still there, and it was in Michigan, and it turned out I had an uncle living there, a brother to my mother, and I stayed at their house for the night. I couldn't believe it. I was talking to one of the sisters, and then someone went and turned the lights off while I was in a cousin's room. When I came out, I stepped into the stairway and fell to the bottom, 16 steps. I stayed on, and I didn't get to the doctor. I was very, very stiff the next day. But I saw a doctor when I got to Kelowna, and he cleared me in his office that nothing was wrong with me. But believe it or not, there was a friend in the office who had fallen that morning and broken a leg. And I really felt convinced. I never again questioned that God was not calling me to Somalia or to work with Muslim people. I never doubted that again in my life. One of the things that I worked for in my work was to always include Somali women as much as I could in their activities, to expose them a bit more and to give them more training. We had schools, but very often the girls did not come. Very often it was boys that came. But in the end, at a mission meeting, I had insisted that a woman be invited to lead devotions. Well, guess what? No one responded to that, and I ended up being the one that was invited. In the end, I led, but some of the men got up and left because I was a woman while I was speaking. Later, they came to me and asked me for some help. So the world is always unpredictable. When I started the bookstore, when I came back to America and started working in the Provident bookstore, I moved to Goshen, Indiana to do it. And I made a number of changes. Well, they had a store here already, but I made quite a number of changes in how I handled things. I asked that we move my office downstairs. It was upstairs because I wanted to be closer to see what was happening, and it was moved downstairs. And then the Sunday school materials all went upstairs, and I increased many different things and cut out some things that had been part of it. I increased the children's books and spirituality and the selection of music tapes and records. I can now observe the main part of the store from my office. The salespeople from the companies thought when they first met me that I was a missionary home, so I would be very suitable for what they wanted. And then lo and behold, they discovered that there were some things I didn't want, and that I was much more for peace and justice things than they were. If they sent me a dump or a display of something I didn't want, I sent it back. And they understood after a bit that I had a mind of my own. One of the things, because I had failed in writing the mission story, it put me on a new spiritual journey. And I learned to attend retreats. And I ended up having a spiritual director. And I became exposed to different material than I had ever been exposed to before. Just to name a few, the writings of Morton Kelsey and Henry Nouwen, just to name a few. I loved it when I could take a course at Goshen College or something at the seminary. I lived on 11th Street in Goshen, and I was overwhelmed by all the Mennonite churches. You know, I had an Amish background, and then I'd been in Africa for 20 years. And so I really hadn't kept up with the Mennonite churches. Thank God I chose Assembly, because I could walk to church. It has been a blessing to be a member here. We care and work about the issues that I care about. After there was a point in which I had returned to Nairobi, Kenya, to provide a mission contact because we could no longer be inside Somalia. The first president was assassinated, and they had been pro-American. And then the second president was pro-Russia. And so I was sent to Nairobi to stay in contact with the believers on the inside for MCC and for Eastern Board. Just in closing, let me say a few things that were important in my life as a single person. My Amish background, I was used to being different and it didn't bother me. I could still relate to all kinds of people. I was blessed by the spirituality of my parents. They did not object to my going to Africa, and that they came to New York, they were in the East, to see me off. Another thing that was a blessing, a family that cared for me, but my education, my opportunity for education. I got a BS in L.Ed., and then I was able to do something in Islam and Arabic, and then later on I got a master's in teaching English. And then it was a gift, the trust that the mission board had for me in asking me to do different things. And the Provident bookstore experience was also a blessing for me because I know that we influence what happened in different places. And I know from my experience that my life, because of my personal faith, will end well as it has been so far.
Well, I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk about singleness in church today, and I'll call it an opportunity, even though now that I'm up here, I'm not quite so sure. On one hand, I'm excited that a church topic is actually focusing on me, and on the other hand, I'm realizing that a church topic is actually focusing on me. And I'm up here sharing my experiences as a never-married single person. As you'll see from the difference in my and Bertha's sharing, singleness is a journey that is unique for each person that is on this journey, or has passed through singleness as a season of life. As Michael mentioned, the title of this Sunday's theme is The Gifts of Singleness. There are certainly gifts of singleness, but there are also many challenges, just as there are in marriage or other relationships. In fact, I have a book on my bookshelf entitled, If Singleness is a Gift, What's the Return Policy? Gifts of singleness for me have included flexibility, opportunity to travel, to invest time and energy in a career, and the ability to make decisions about my life or choices that impact very few people. But in contrast, challenges of singleness for me have included loneliness, a feeling of not really fitting in anywhere, and a deep, long-seated desire for a life partner, a husband to share and do life with. So what do you do with a journey and path that you didn't expect? I'm sure many of us here have wrestled with this question, whether it your journey has included sickness, divorce, or loss in some way. Being a never-married single in my 40s is not the path I expected to be on. I've had a desire for a husband and a family for a long time. Why hasn't God met this desire or taken away my desire? As I continue to wrestle with this question, I have found God to be faithful, even amidst my many questions. I have wondered over the years, how does this happen for other people? People meet, they start dating. It seems to come so naturally. Am I doing something wrong? What is wrong with me? Did I choose the wrong door in the game show of life? Do you remember that? Choose the three doors or something? Do I need to be more outgoing? Have I given too much to my job or career? And even though I have a wide circle of friends and acquaintances, those friendships and connections can sometimes seem somewhat shallow. In the challenges of our busy lives and the pairing off of most people, who's giving me priority? Am I the only one who's noticing me and my needs? One challenge is not having the ability to solve this on my own. As a natural problem solver, I want to find the solution to my problem, to analyze it, to figure out the right path, and get the result I'm looking for. But life and relationships don't work that way, and singleness shouldn't be a problem to solve. Cameron Courtney formerly wrote a column on singleness for Christianity Today and is a writer who I have come to appreciate. As a single person herself, she is honest about the ups and downs of daily life as a single person, and she often found ways to express what I had a hard time expressing. She describes this challenge of powerlessness this way, and I quote, "I realized one of the most maddening parts about wanting a good, God-honoring marriage is the lack of my power, is my lack of power to make it happen. Sure, I can circulate where single men hang out, ask friends to set me up, go out with a guy if they ever ask, but none of my efforts will make a man who's a good fit for me suddenly materialize. And while that powerlessness can frustrate me, it can also shape me. Having an ongoing longing in my life reminds me that God is the one who gives and takes away. My still singleness keeps me humble, not because it suggests that I'm a loser, but because it reminds me that my good efforts can only go so far, that I desperately need God's grace, and that God is faithful when we experience both plenty and want. Some days my singleness makes me think of the thorn in the flesh that kept Paul from becoming conceited, as talked about in 2 Corinthians 12. He begged God to take this mysterious affliction away, but God communicated, "No, I'll do one better. I'll meet you in the pain." On my good days, when I let it, singleness plays this role in my life as well. Instead of taking away my longing, God can meet me richly in it. Of course, this realization doesn't diminish my desire for a spouse and doesn't take away my occasional frustration. End quote. I realized long ago that I am not called to singleness. At times, my singleness has been a place of deep personal hurt, a place of happiness and contentment, and it continues to be a place of deep longing. I have tried to give up this desire, to let it go, but it is the boomerang that keeps coming back. I have felt somewhat guilty to continue to have this longing when God has poured out blessing in many other areas of my life. I believe that God has the ability to take away this longing if God wanted to, but for some reason that hasn't happened. And believe me, I've tried to give it to God. I'm really tired of carrying it. But for now, the longing for marriage remains. Deep down, I know this is a search for a place of belonging, intimacy, and connection. And it has helped build my trust in God, reminding me that God knows the broader picture, that God is working in the midst of my singleness. So I'm not going to apologize or let go of my desire for marriage or a life partner, even though I know these relationships come with their own set of challenges. Married people are messy and broken, just like single people are messy and broken. Relationships take risk, and avoiding the risk often means avoiding the relationship and the opportunity for conversation, connection, and intimacy. As we've talked about in previous weeks of this series, as human beings, we all have a desire for connection, to be known and to be loved. How do I be a sexual being as a single person? How do I create intimacy with others? Without sexual intimacy, what does this look like? How do I build the trust that is necessary in healthy relationships? These are all unanswered and good questions and worthy of exploration and hopefully answers. One of the main things I have learned as a single person is that contentment and longing can and do live side by side. They can coexist. It's a paradox. It is possible to simultaneously enjoy the perks of singleness and also long for it to end. Living with both contentment and longing takes courage and creativity and a lot of emotional energy. It also requires moments of honesty and vulnerability about our unmet desires. So where is the church in all this? I hope the church can be a place of belonging for singles, that people seek out connection, that pastors ask about our pastoral care needs, that small groups can be a place of support and a way to build connection and intimacy. Most importantly, the church can be about creating places for listening and conversation, which builds understanding for those in different life circumstances than our own. I spent a long time in my singleness journey praying the beginning words of Psalm 13. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart? Look on me and answer, O Lord my God. Now I try to focus more on the ending words of Psalm 13, this lament psalm that ends in praise. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord, for the Lord has been good to me. May it continue to be so.